Hello and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. We have today back on the show with us Dr. Rob Sheldon. To pick up where we left off on our previous podcast, Dr. Sheldon received his PhD in physics from the University of Maryland, and he has worked at the University of Bern in Switzerland, Boston University, and the University of Alabama in Huntsville. He's currently consulting with NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center, and we're going to pick up where we left off in the previous podcast discussing cosmology and how there has been a paradigm shift in cosmology from an eternal static universe to a finite universe that had a beginning, and what the implications of that are for theism, materialism, and intelligent design. So, Dr. Sheldon, obviously one scientist who was not religious and talked a lot about the Big Bang was Fred Hoyle. He was a well-known atheist, and he did not always agree with the idea of a finite universe and a Big Bang. How did he respond to the evidence for a finite universe, and do you think that he was philosophically motivated?
Well, I never got to meet Fred Hoyle. Several of my colleagues here in the department were very good friends with him. But Fred Hoyle viewed himself as a materialist, as a atheist. He said, "I am of the same opinion as Democritus. Nothing comes from nothing." And so Fred Hoyle was upset that the universe could not have lasted for an eternal amount of time. And this whole story of how astronomy dealt with the discovery of the Big Bang is recorded in Robert Jastrow's book, I think it was published in 1979, entitled God and the Astronomers. And Robert Jastrow was an astronomer, and he said so many of his colleagues were just deeply disturbed by this discovery of the beginning of the universe. Fred Hoyle sort of deserved the Nobel Prize one or two times, but Fred Hoyle was, as somebody put it, the son of a Cornish coal miner. He would always be stubborn about the truth, and he looked at evolution and said there's no way that evolution has time to create all of what we see around us in the 12 billion years since the Big Bang. And so Fred Hoyle said, then in order for evolution to work, you had to have an infinite amount of time. And so his solution was to say, we can construct a steady state universe that will have been around for eternity and still look the same as the world today. And even when Lemaître and Einstein had this solution for the Big Bang, in fact, Fred Hoyle named it the Big Bang, he was trying to make fun of it. And that's why he came up with that silly sounding title for this event. But Fred Hoyle thought that he could get the same effect with the steady state universe. And in 1963, a couple of Bell Labs technicians and scientists were trying to get rid of a background microwave signal. And they realized that they were measuring the noise or the light from the Big Bang 12 billion years ago, 13 billion years ago, and it was cooled now so much that it was now in the microwave range. And that discovery just sort of put Fred Hoyle out of business. And so he never really accepted his defeat, and to his dying day kind of resisted the idea that there was ever a Big Bang, simply because he wanted there to be no creator.
That's very interesting, Dr. Sheldon, and it makes you wonder what other theories are going on in cosmology that maybe are philosophically motivated. Maybe you could tell us another story along these lines about how Einstein inserted his cosmological constant and why he did that. And also, why has the cosmological constant come back in recent years, and what does that mean for cosmology?
That's an interesting topic, too. The cosmological constant was a term that created anti-gravity. And so Einstein writes down his gravitational equations that show space-time should be warped and clumping together, and he wants the universe to last forever. This is 1917. Einstein hadn't really heard about Slipher's galaxy data, but Einstein wanted the universe to be eternal because, frankly, Einstein was an atheist as well. When he was questioned by students if he believed in God, his answer was, "I believe in Spinoza's God," which is a sort of generic deist God that sort of creates, if you can call it creating, and then sort of vanishes from the scene. So Einstein didn't really want a creation event. So he looks at his equations and he says, you know, if I put in some anti-gravity to balance out the gravitational attraction, then the whole system can be stable and stay exactly in balance. And he called that term the cosmological constant. And when Lemaître showed that you could get a expansion of the universe that matched Slipher, and that this would keep the universe from clumping back together again. At first, Einstein didn't even respond to Lemaître. He didn't even seem to acknowledge that it was a good solution. But more and more people started to say this is the best explanation for how the universe shows these galaxies moving away from us. And so finally, Einstein was convinced, and he said, well, I'll take that term out, and it was the biggest mistake I ever made. But then when we started to find out how accurately the expansion of the universe was, scientists and cosmologists got very nervous again. And the problem is that the universe has to be expanding at just the right speed to match the slowing down of gravity. If it expands a little too slowly, if the bang wasn't big enough, then gravity wins and it all falls into a clump. If it expands too much, then it means the little gas molecules are moving away from each other. They never clump at all. They don't form stars. They don't form galaxies. And then we wouldn't be here to talk about it. So it has to be just expanding at a very critical factor. And balancing between those two, according to Stephen Hawking, is one part in 10 to the 60th. That means 10 with 60 zeros after it. This is such an enormously big number, it's hard to grasp. This is my explanation of how to understand that 10 to the 60th. There are thought to be 10 to the 88th protons in the visible universe. So if you divide by 10 to the 60th, you get 10 to the 20th protons. Well, if you put together 10 to the 20th protons, they're about the size of a grain of sand. So what this fine-tuning of the expansion rate means is if we had one more grain of sand in our universe or one more grain of sand less in our universe, it would have collapsed into a black hole and we wouldn't be here to talk about it. And that's how accurately this expansion rate has to be. And the cosmologists looked at that and they said, we've got a real problem because that makes it look as if the universe was planned. And again, we're back to a creator. And so they tried to solve this problem by putting in an extra expansion term, an anti-gravity term. So they re-invoked Einstein's cosmological constant and said, if we put it back into the equations, then we can start to explain why we live in the universe we do without fine-tuning. They also had to add something called the inflation field. All of these stories are well documented in Stanley Yockey's book, God and the Cosmologist. You can think of it as a sequel to Robert Jastrow's book. Stanley Yockey died 5 or 6 years ago, but he was a PhD in physics and a PhD in philosophy, and he wrote a lot about how philosophy informs cosmology. And he said it's this desire to get rid of the creator that caused people to bring back the cosmological constant in their models again. So I'll stop there. I could go on for a long time on that.
That's really fascinating. So just a couple last questions here, Dr. Sheldon. Does the size of the universe, whether it's infinite or finite, make any difference as to whether it can house life? How does that impact fine-tuning considerations?
Well, one of the reasons that people who get rid of a creator want the universe to be infinite in space as well as infinite in time is that they think that somehow that if you increase your probabilistic resources, if you're waiting for a warm pond somewhere in the universe, then it's more likely to have a warm pond if you have an infinite size universe. And so they think that because they can make the space so much bigger, they have a better chance for random chance for life to occur. And my argument is that when you look at a cell, 1 or 2 micron, 10 micron across, the amount of information, the amount of machinery in that cell is enormously complicated and dense and small. And so life is not just information in the generic. Einstein said nothing travels faster than the speed of light. So if your computer was so big that you couldn't communicate from one corner of the universe to the other, then the computer might as well be a little computer because it couldn't see any of the rest of its computational abilities. So life has to be small in order to communicate, to get the thing to work. And so what really matters is the information density. And in that case, an expanding infinite universe is diluting the matter and the information in it. And it makes it less probable for life to occur because that lowers the density of information. So if you want life to happen in this universe, I don't think it helps at all. In fact, it hurts to have an expanding universe or an infinite universe.
If you're a materialist, that is.
If you're a materialist, that's right.
So let's just close this up here, Dr. Sheldon. What are Boltzmann brains? And if the chemical origin of life is more improbable than a Boltzmann brain, should we consider it a viable hypothesis?
A Boltzmann brain comes about because Boltzmann said if you've got a closed number of atoms or states in a box, you just have to wait long enough and it will repeat to where it was before. So the particles bouncing around will eventually come back and start over again, doing exactly what they did before. And so Boltzmann brains are saying, well, if life is so improbable, then perhaps a few electrons got together and made it appear or made us think that we were alive when really we're just thinking about it, because the electrons needed for our brain to simulate life is more probable than the actual machinery in those cells to become life. And so the Boltzmann brain idea is that all over the universe, the electrons are getting together, and for a brief moment, there's a thought or a consciousness that thinks it's alive, and that we are perhaps one of those Boltzmann brains, because that's far more probable than having all of the atoms get together to make a cell. It's a way for probability calculation. You're saying, if it really is as improbable as we say to create life, then what are some of the things that are more probable than that? And I think the answer to the Boltzmann brain paradox that is confronting materialists is to say that the materialist conclusion that the atoms that make us up are all randomly collected is wrong, that the Boltzmann brain paradox disappears once we realize that there's some purpose, some teleology, some design going on. And then it becomes much more probable that we are here.
Well, Dr. Sheldon, we appreciate your helpful explanations of some of these complicated concepts in the field of cosmology and appreciate the work you're doing. So thanks for giving us your time today on ID the Future.
Thank you, Casey.
Well, I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Stay tuned for more with Dr. Rob Sheldon. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.